coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. As President Biden and GOP lawmakers continue negotiations on a federal infrastructure spending deal, Delaware's senior senator says he sees bipartisan progress on getting some things done.
There's a lot of agreement on where we need to work on the water side. Let's do that. We have. I need to do a lot on the roads, highways, bridges side. Let's do that. There's a lot of need to do work on broadband connection. And at the end of the day, we'll see what it all adds up to.
Senator Tom Carper visits The Green to discuss infrastructure and more. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also get an update on where Delaware stands in delivering on its promises in the state education funding lawsuit settlement. Plus, Arts Playlist looks ahead to an exhibition coming to the Brandywine River Museum of Art. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last fall, the lawsuit demanding changes to the state's education funding system was settled, and since then, state and county governments have moved to start fulfilling the obligations set out for them in those settlements. This week, contributor Larry Nangas takes a closer look at what's been accomplished so far, and if calls from advocates for even more to be done will be heeded. That piece is at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to lay out what he found. So what a difference one school year makes. As you note in your piece, before the school year started, there was still a possibility the state education funding lawsuit could see its day in court. Now it's settled. In the end, does this wind up being kind of a surprising turn of events that we've kind of made this leap forward?
Well, last August and September, you would have had to consider this surprising. Especially the settlement on the state's portion of the lawsuit. I mean, even the people who were closest to the case were expecting the suit to go to trial. But a couple of things changed the calculus. One was the COVID-19 pandemic, which seemed to have had an impact on every aspect of our lives in the past year. And as the school year began with remote and hybrid instruction, it was no longer possible to ignore the reality that the students with the greatest needs, the low-income kids and the English learners, were the ones who faced the greatest difficulty receiving their lessons. Now, on top of that, at the time, you remember, there was a lot of pessimism about how the pandemic would mean less tax revenue flowing to governments and to school districts. And that fear may have nudged the plaintiffs in the case to accept a little bit less than they might have wanted rather than risk going to trial and perhaps getting nothing at all. Now, on the other hand, the victories by progressives in the Democratic primaries in September may have led Governor Carney to believe that the incoming lawmakers would be pushing even harder for more education spending. So when you consider the changing dynamics here, it kind of made sense for both sides to look towards a settlement, and that's eventually what would occur.
So let's recap where things stand right now, starting out at the county level and reassessment. Where is that piece of the lawsuit settlement's headed?
The settlement of the county portion of the suit took longer than the state portion, but it was actually a little bit less surprising. Last spring, Vice Chancellor J. Travis Laster issued a 149-page opinion that pretty much shredded the county's arguments in the case. And the Vice Chancellor ruled that the current real estate assessment system violated the state's constitution because the assessments were so old, some of them dating back to the 1970s, that they were an unreliable measure of current property values. The judge put off imposing a remedy, but still, the solution was pretty obvious. The counties would have to conduct property reassessments. It was just a matter of coming up with the how and the when. And between January and April of this year, the counties did agree to conduct the reassessments, and they should be done in time to be used on the tax bills that will be sent out 3 years from now.
And the settlement of the state portion of the suit requires the legislature to carry out what the governor agreed to do. Where is the General Assembly in that process?
Well, the General Assembly has passed Senate Bill 86, and this is legislation that established establishes opportunity funds, which are special funding dedicated for use on programs for low-income students and English learners. And Governor Carney is expected to sign that legislation sometime this month. Now, there are other pieces of legislation that will be required before the settlement is totally completed, and increases in funding for several programs as well. But Senate Bill 86 is the piece that's essential for this year, and the other pieces of legislation can be acted on next year and the year that follows that.
Now, with a healthy budget surplus for the state, it appears the call by some lawmakers and advocates to do more than just the basics of this settlement is gaining some traction. Where is the state going above and beyond at this point in terms of spending on education funding?
Well, I think in this context, you've got to look at really two different categories of spending and legislating. First, there is this idea of accelerating implementation of the terms of the settlement, getting it done faster. And then there are also recommendations from the state's commission, Reading Consortium on Education Equity. Now, as for acceleration, a key piece of legislation required by the settlement would change the funding structure for special education students in kindergarten through third grade. So it would increase the funding for students in those levels to match the levels that are now provided for grades 4 through 12. Now, the settlement doesn't require this piece to be enacted until 2 years from now, but legislation to start sooner has already been introduced by Representative Kim Williams. Now, it might not come to a vote this year, but it is certainly going to be at the top of the to-do lists for next year. Now, as for the Reading Consortium, they are pushing for legislation to create mental health units in elementary schools, and that legislation has also been introduced this session. Also, Senator Tizzy Lockman, who is the co-chair of the Reading Consortium and a member of the Joint Finance Committee, has gotten the JFC to add $10 million to the next state budget to pay for some new and expanded programs that the consortium supports. So there's action there, both related directly to the settlement and to the Reading Consortium, both of which are going to tend to push things forward. It's not clear about how quickly, but it is going to move things forward.
There's also a resolution asking the Department of Education to create a report by September 1st on a variety of equity-related funding issues. What's the goal of this resolution?
The measure, House Concurrent Resolution 24, is significant because it represents the first step toward this other important goal for education reformers, modernizing the state system of school funding. And now, this proposal has a strong chance of passage this year because about 25 legislators have already signed on as co-sponsors. Now, the state's unit system of funding has been in place for about 80 years. Meanwhile, and actually more certainly in the last 10 years or so, more and more states have been revising their funding systems to make them more flexible and more responsive to meeting the needs of children who require the most support. The resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 24, calls on the Department of Education to work with other key state agencies to prepare a report, and this is by September, that would include some very interesting financial metrics, like how much money per pupil districts collect from property taxes, how much money per pupil each district receives from the state, with per pupil breakdowns by district for some of these categories that we've been talking about today, the low-income special education students and English learners. Now, that's a lot of number crunching to have to get done in about 3 months, but it will create a very helpful database to start a broader analysis of the school funding system and how to improve it.
Now, when we asked Governor Carney about that resolution and doing more beyond the settlement recently, he focused more on student achievement and making sure money spent is producing results. Is this kind of the next phase on this issue, those who want to do more and do it right now, and those looking to take this kind of more wait-and-see approach before taking further steps?
I think we would all agree with the governor that improving student achievement is important. But the fact is, we already have mechanisms that would help show, although not necessarily in the clearest ways possible, the relationships between spending and student achievement. Now, specifically, let's refer to the reporting requirements that are listed in Senate Bill 148, which was signed by Governor Carney 3 years ago. Let's keep in mind also that every other state, almost every other state, including our neighbors, provides more targeted funding for students with the greatest needs than Delaware does. Reform advocates cite research showing that this funding has a positive impact. So, if anyone in Delaware wants to see whether additional targeted funding works, all they have to do is look across the state lines. And if they want to see what the impact of limited targeted spending is in Delaware, the comparisons can be made by analyzing the data that's required by Senate Bill 148. So, the information here, if you want to talk about whether we should wait or whether we should do this now, the data is already out there and it's available.
Are there some other pieces of the settlement that we haven't touched on? And is there any sense where they stand?
Yeah, there are two here that are worth mentioning at this point. First of all, the settlement called for creating an ombudsman program, contracting with one or more independent organizations to work as independent advocates on behalf of students and their families if they encounter what they think is unfair treatment in discipline or in access to school programs. Now, the Department of Education a couple of months back issued a request for proposals, and the responses to those proposals were due back earlier this week. As a result, the department's in a position where it could award a contract as early as next month. Secondly, the Department of Education is working on a request for proposals that would lead to hiring a contractor to conduct what the settlement calls an independent funding assessment and deliver that report to the governor, to legislative leaders, and to the Department of Education by January of 2024. Now, that report, which would have to be done by an organization that is independent of the state, would analyze state education funding procedures and make recommendations to improve equity and efficiency. Typically, there's a turnaround time of a couple of months on proposals like this, so I would expect that the contract here would be awarded probably sometime in the fall.
So circling back to where we started, when the school year started, there was pessimism about the education lawsuit, where it stood, what was next. Now there's a settlement and some movement. In talking to the people you did for this story, is there a sense of how big a step this past year has been, how much progress is actually being made, and conversely, how much remains undone or unanswered?
Yes. I think back in October, when the state portion of the settlement was announced, I tried to summarize it all in one sentence. And I guess I can repeat now what I wrote then, because it still holds true today. I said, it's a big deal, but it's not a done deal. And it's not the whole deal either. And that really says where we are here in June of 2021. See, right now we are seeing this convergence of these two key issues, equity in education for historically disadvantaged students, and this desire to reform an 80-year-old funding mechanism that many say is no longer responsive to a school system that is far more diverse and far more complex than it was in the 1940s and 1950s when that funding system was created. Now, these issues, of course, do overlap. And right now, with the settlement, and the indications are that these required legislative actions are coming together. We're seeing the resolution of the equity issue, but we're probably, 4 or 5 years down the road from actually writing the final chapter here. Now, tying all the pieces together is still going to be a slow and careful process. Now, as for finance reform, that's been talked about for 15 years or so. But this time it looks like it's finally much more likely that the talk is going to lead to real action. Even so, this issue is incredibly complex, and the current system is embedded in the DNA of school finance officers throughout the state. So, going forward, observers may feel that they're watching finance reform action advance in slow motion, maybe even in freeze frame mode, but at least it's getting started.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece updating where changes to the state's education funding system stand is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay tuned. The Green continues next with my conversation with Senator Tom Carper about the congressional debate over infrastructure spending and more. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. One of the big stories in Washington, D.C. is the negotiations over President Biden's infrastructure plan. And as that plays out on Capitol Hill, Delaware's senior senator Tom Carper has a vital role as chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Carper visited The Green earlier this week to discuss the federal debate over infrastructure spending and some other issues before Congress. Let's talk about infrastructure now. That is a very hot topic, certainly negotiations continuing over the president's plan and some counteroffers from your Republican colleagues. As chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, you're deeply involved in this infrastructure process. And just last week, the committee you chair passed the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Act of 2021 unanimously.
Did you say unanimously?
I did say that. And that's kind of the nut of this question. You're talking about $303.5 billion over 5 years, 34% increase over the last reauthorization. To pass that unanimously, does that indicate wide support for this type of infrastructure, the traditional type of infrastructure?
I think it does. There's a large large parts of our country, and some in Delaware, but especially bad in other parts. Go up to Pennsylvania, for example. The roads are in not such great shape in other places. We're doing a heck of a lot of work here in Delaware. If you're on I-95, you know what I mean.
Yep.
Right now, huge project there. Short-term pain, long-term gain there. But the federal government's not responsible for all the funding for roads, highways, bridges in the country. Federal government has a significant role to play, and we do. Every 5 years, we pass a major surface transportation reauthorization bill to reauthorize programs that fund roads, highways, bridges across the country. And the federal government provides some of the payments. Some roads, like I-95, the bulk of the payment comes from the federal government.
Right.
Other roads are maybe paid for by state or local. There's a lot of states and counties pay for a whole lot of work on the roads. But it's a shared responsibility. And the greatest, as it turns out, the greatest source of carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in our country, come from our mobile sources, our cars, trucks, and vans. So we're working on a compromise between Democrats and Republicans to not only rebuild our roads, highways, and bridges, but build back better. We're having this extreme weather that is damaging to our roads, highways, bridges, makes them harder to build, rebuild. And so we're trying to be very smart in terms of resilience. And also, the president's called for creating charging stations and fueling stations across the country where there's a lot of movement of cars, trucks, and vans. And we include in our language several billions of dollars for the federal contribution toward charging stations and fueling stations. Most people, almost everybody's heard of electric vehicles and
right.
Tesla, and we've got now the Ford Mustang is electric. The Ford F-150 truck, they're going to have those electric, and GM has the Chevrolet Bolt, and other manufacturers have cars. The sale of electric vehicles is going to take off. Really going to take off. They're so much fun to drive, and they're low on maintenance. They just don't break down a lot. The internal combustion engine with all the clean air stuff that's on it to try to reduce emissions, that's a hard system to maintain. You don't have that with electric vehicles. So they've got the auto companies have gotten the ability to get when they charge, when they charge the batteries on these vehicles. It used to be like the Chevrolet Volt, which was a long time ago, one of the first vehicles
right.
we did this. It got 38 miles on a charge. My son and I went out and drove a couple of weeks ago a bunch of vehicles, including Chevy, including Ford, including Tesla. And we rode in a number of vehicles that didn't get 38 miles on a charge. They got over 300 miles on a
right.
charge. And the key is the auto manufacturers say we can build all the vehicles that get over 300 miles or 400 miles on a charge, but if they don't have places to charge them across the country, then we can't sell them. So in our bill, service transportation bill, we're going to have places to charge them. The other thing, the sleeper here is hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Hydrogen. Hydrogen can be used in conjunction with fuel cells to create electricity, including electricity in vehicles that propel cars, trucks, and vans. It's especially promising for trucks, mid-sized mm-hmm. trucks and large trucks. So we're going to be building these quarters of charging stations and fueling stations, again, looking to the future with hydrogen for trucks and mid-sized trucks. And a lot of jobs will be created in terms of rebuilding the roads, a lot of jobs. And we'll make our economy more productive. We just better. One of the keys to economic development is having good transportation systems. And our systems are hurting in a lot of places, so we're going to make them better and build back better, and it'll strengthen our economy.
The bill also looks at focusing some of the funding on underserved communities and those places that were previously divided by highway construction. And there has been a push this year in Wilmington talking about a project to cap I-95 in Wilmington to help address the kind of division that that highway created in the city in the 1960s. Is that the type of project that would be ripe for this type of funding in this bill?
Yeah, there are a lot of places across the country where the interstate system was built through towns, and it literally cut towns in half. A lot of those construction projects went through communities of color and folks who didn't have very good connections and a lot of ability to say, you can't build that road, that interstate highway through my community. And a lot of them were. And so we have an I-95. We have I-95 that literally cuts the city of Wilmington in half. And what some cities across the country are doing is taking matters in their own hands, and they're sort of like capping them and coming up with very clever ways to be able to reconnect communities, but it still provide for good movement of cars, trucks, and vans. We included in our bill a $500 million pilot to try this out and see how it works. I like to say, find out what works, do more of that. And the idea is to find out what works and use a pilot program to do that. We also have a call for in our legislation a 50-state pilot of something called vehicle miles travel. Whenever people buy gasoline in this country, they pay about 19 cents a gallon in federal gas. I call it a user fee. You know, it's not like a traditional tax. You pay it only if you're going to use the roads, highways, and bridges. But it's 19 cents a gallon for gasoline. It's about 25 cents a gallon for diesel. We've not raised it for 25 years or more. And the purchasing power of those fees is about half of what it was originally. And we need to adjust those. And to do not all at once, but adjust them over time to restore the purchasing power. But eventually, we're going to go, I think, Tom, we're going to go to something they've done in Oregon and other states. It's called vehicle miles travel. Yeah. And in Oregon, it doesn't matter if you drive a gasoline-powered vehicle, a diesel-powered vehicle, a hydrogen-powered vehicle. If you're using the roads, you're going to pay for the miles that you travel. I think that's a much smarter approach. And eventually, that's the future. That's how we're going to largely pay for roads, highways, bridges in the future. And I think that's a smart way to do it. And we're not going to just turn a switch and be able to do that all at once. But we're going to do a 50-state pilot. Delaware's already been part of the pilot to test it out.
Yep.
And then we'll probably 7, 8, 9 years from now, we'll turn on the switch for real.
Speaking with Senator Tom Carper here on The Green, and I wanted to ask you, looking beyond the surface transportation reauthorization, what are your thoughts on some of the other things that the president is seeking in terms of infrastructure and the possibility of finding a deal between what the president offered and obviously what many in the GOP want, a smaller infrastructure package?
Yeah. Well, a month ago, my committee on Environment and Public Works also brought up to the Senate legislation we passed unanimously in committee earlier this year, and it's to build and rebuild our water systems. Used to be that years ago, I guess when I was a pup of a politician, I was a state treasurer, the federal government helped to fund water projects, sewage project, drinking water project, through a grant process. If states wanted to get some money from the federal government, from EPA, after the Clean Water Bill was signed into law, they would apply for a grant. And if they had a good project, then there's enough money, they'd get the grant. And that was the way it worked. When Ronald Reagan became president, he said we wanted to try something different. And what he came up with was every state established in 50 states revolving funds.
Mm-hmm.
One of the revolving funds was for drinking water, and one of the revolving funds for each state was for wastewater sanitation, for cleaning up sewage water.
Right.
And the idea is a community within a state applies for money from that state's revolving fund, and they use that along with some other monies to build, you know, drinking water or clean wastewater, wastewater sanitation. That we haven't reauthorized the Clean Water Revolving Trust Fund, I think it's sort of 25 years, and the Drinking Water Revolving Fund expires later this year. So we've passed legislation to extend these programs for another 5 years to significantly increase the federal funding and to target them on communities of need. rural communities, tribal communities, Eskimo communities, where there's just a lot of poverty. And the idea is to provide a little more federal help. And we expect people who are drinking water, they're going to pay for part of their share as well. State and locals will pay for part of it. But we've passed a $36 billion five-year water infrastructure. We passed that unanimously in our committee, which is pretty unusual for most committees. We do some of this stuff unanimously. We passed it unanimously, brought it to the floor, debated it, and passed it on the floor 89-2. We don't pass many bills 89-2 in the United States Senate. So that was just a wonderful, wonderful day when we did that. And that's part of the president's Build Back Better, better water infrastructure for drinking water and wastewater. The another piece of it is transportation, service transportation. Roads, highways, bridges are a big part of that. But we also have like intercity passenger rail, which includes Amtrak, which is a big thing on here on the East Coast, and it should be a bigger thing across the country. The we have more people who travel by a train now from Washington to New York City than by airplane. All the airlines combined, there's more people on Amtrak. And there are a bunch of city pairs across the country where you might say like Richmond to Atlanta or Chicago to Detroit, L.A. to San Francisco. We call them city pairs, where it makes a whole lot of sense instead of people like flying in airplanes for like 300-400 miles, which is hugely polluting. A lot of greenhouse gases come out of the planes. Why don't we just get people, improve the rail systems? There are already a whole lot of the freight rail lines own these rail tracks between city pairs, and the idea would be to bring them up to snuff so they're going not 50 miles an hour but 100 miles an hour, and the Amtrak would share, the passenger trains would share the tracks with the freights. And not an easy thing. It's easier said than done, but that's going to be part of the infrastructure. The other part, we got a lot of kids they're finishing up school. And for a lot of kids, they've not learned nearly as much as they need to. And so some where you have maybe one parent's working, yeah. Children left at home. A lot of kids just never sign on and start the school day. That's just awful. They've fallen way, way, way behind. We put a lot of money in our last COVID package, legislative package, Tom, to pay for summer school. Rigorous summer school, not babysitting, but rigorous summer school, math, science, English, social studies, and to provide the money to help get kids to school, feed them breakfast and lunch, get them home, but actually help them catch up because there's a lot of them are way behind.
Is there a minimum amount of money?
In conjunction with that, not everybody has the ability to access the internet.
Right.
And especially in a situation where you have kids going to school remotely, and it could be rural areas, it could be urban areas, but we have a lot of businesses across the country you have farmers across the country who need the internet for what they do, and a big part of what the president's calling for, and there's a huge bipartisan support for doing a better job on the internet connection, and so I think if you think about water. Addressing our water needs, if you think about our roads, highways, bridges, you think about better rail service, you think about broadband connection, there's a lot of agreement on that. And my hope is that will provide a foundation to move a large legislative package.
Is there a minimum amount you think is necessary? I mean, the president been talking about $2 trillion, maybe moving it down to $1.7 trillion. The Republicans are much further down on that spectrum of spending. Is there a number in your mind you feel like would be kind of the floor for what you would expect to make a package like this
overall,
work?
I don't have an overall number. The president says let's go big, and he's made his proposal and all some real good ideas in it. And what I'm doing it like, I call it regular order, say one step at a time. There's a lot of agreement on where we need to work on the water side. Let's do that. We have. There's a need to do a lot on the roads, highways, bridges side. Let's do that. And we're doing that. There's a lot of need to do work on broadband connection. And we're seeing a beginning of that. So let's just, and at the end of the day, we'll see what it all adds up to. But there's some of the highest needs. And I think there's a lot of support, Democrat and Republican, within government, out of government.
You mentioned some areas where there's been some bipartisan cooperation. One area where there has not been was the bill to create an independent inquiry to investigate the January 6th Capitol Hill riot that failed in the Senate. How disappointing was it to you that failed? And is there any path forward to create some kind of investigation of what happened on January 6th?
Oh, absolutely. I never forget the day, Tom, that I was riding a train to Washington, D.C. on 9/11 in 2001. And I was in a call with my staff. My staff said, there's an airplane that's like that appears to have crashed into one of the World Trade Towers. And I said, oh, my God. Turned out about 15, 20 minutes later, my staff called me back, and he said another airplane has crashed into the World Trade Center. And they said something's terribly wrong here. And I'll never forget, I got off the train at Union Station, oh gosh, about 30, 40 minutes later, I stepped off the train. And as soon as I stepped off the train, I could hear the sirens going off. I could hear the fighter aircraft that was scrambled and flying over the Capitol. And I went into our office building, went up, turned on the television, and to find out what was going on. And it was just an unbelievable day. And for anybody who was alive that day, will never forget it. In the heels of this, we agreed, Democrats and Republicans, George W. Bush was our president. He did a very good job leading our country during a tough time. And we agreed to create a 9/11 commission, a bipartisan commission, roughly 10 or 12 highly regarded citizens. And the commission would be co-chaired by a former Republican governor of New Jersey, Tom Kane, mm-hmm. and a former Democratic congressman from Indiana, Lee Hamilton, who I believe was a House Foreign Relations Committee chair, highly, highly respected men. And they were surrounded by a bipartisan commission. I think it was like 10 people, with people like John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy. And we asked them to do two things, find out what happened, how did this ever happen? How does that happen? And then to find out what were the root causes. We provided staff, subpoena power. They came up with 41 recommendations unanimously made to the Congress. We adopted almost all of them. And we still have concerns with the attacks, you know, cyber attacks and, you know, terrorist attacks. But boy, they did great work for our country. Fast forward, we've had this terrible attack on our Capitol. That led to loss of life, and there's a need to find out what happened. Where were the lapses in security and intelligence and actionable intelligence? Where did we go wrong to allow this to happen? And also, what's going on under the surface? What is actually the root? What are the root causes here? And the idea that was offered in the Congress, the House has passed it, creating a commission, a January 6th commission, sort of like, very much like the 9/11 Commission, bipartisan, and with the ability to gather information, subpoena power, and so on. I think it's a no-brainer. As far as I'm concerned, it's a no-brainer. And why my Republican colleagues are reluctant to go along with it. I said earlier, find some, what works, do more of that. 9/11 Commission worked great. This would work great. We need to do it. I'm interested in getting the truth. I think most people would want to know what happened, what really happened, and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Is there any thought that there's another way here? Is there a presidential commission or something else that could be done in place of what the Congress wouldn't do?
The key behind the 9/11 commission is that it was bipartisan, mm-hmm. that the co-chairs were one's a Democrat, highly regarded, one's a Republican, highly regarded, and the commission itself had just terrific people on board. The Senate Committee on Homeland Security, which I serve on, now the senior Democrat on, and we were led by Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins, one a Democrat, one a Republican, highly regarded people, and people who actually were close friends, close colleagues, and very good working partners in terms of legislation. That helps enormously. I'm not sure where we go from here. I thought Susan Collins worked hard to try to come up with at least 10 or 12 Republican votes last week. To give us the 60 votes that we needed to move forward on a January 6th commission. And at the last minute, all but about six of those Republican votes just disappeared. And I think there's work going on to see if we can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. I sure think so. We need to do this. We need to get to the truth and let the chips fall where they may. Try to make sure that nothing like this happens again.
The situation has kind of rekindled discussion about the filibuster. Does what happened in this situation at all change your feelings on the filibuster and the efforts to change it, eliminate it, or do something about it?
There's a reason why there's a – well, I don't know if it was Jefferson or Franklin was asked early on, what's the difference between the House and the Senate? And the response was – they said, just think of boiling water. So it's really hot, it's bubbling, and you pour it into a teacup. He said the – the boiling water is the passion that you get in the House with younger people and with folks who serve two-year terms. They face the electorate more often. And he said the Senate is the saucer. So the water gets poured into the cup, overflows the cup into the saucer, and cools off. The Senate is the saucer, where cooler heads prevail, and they play the longer game. Our framers had something in mind, and I want to make sure at the end of the day we don't unintentionally destroy that. One of the things that I've said, and I've heard others say this before, be careful of the bed that you make, because you may get the chance to sleep in it. And we Harry Reid, who used to be the leader, Democratic leader in the Senate, led an effort to change the rules with respect to nominating judges and being able to confirm judges with as few as like a majority of votes. And Donald Trump used that for the last 4 years to just nominate and confirm, with the help of Mitch McConnell, an enormous number of radical right-wing judges, and in many cases people who were not recommended by the screening committee, by the American Bar Association. They were deemed to be unqualified. They've ended up as federal district court judges, appeals court judges. That's awful. And the Senate was once called the world's great deliberative body, and this is a time we need to live up to that description. And at the end of the day, if we can't get things done, if we're just in a logjam, we can't get stuff done, then we have to try other options. What I'm trying to do as the leader of the Committee on Environment and Public Works on the water infrastructure side and the service transportation side, to demonstrate that it's still possible for us to work together and get things done. I meet every week, either in person or by phone, with a senator from West Virginia, a Republican named Shelley Capito, and we just talk. And we talk about what her priorities are, what the priorities are from the Republican members of our committee, and about what our priorities are on the Democratic side. And we work toward a common cause. Joe Biden likes to say, I've heard him say it many times, all politics is personal, all diplomacy is personal. And what I've tried to do is just build personal relationships with Democrats and Republicans in order to find consensus, build consensus, and to get things done.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper for joining us on The Green this week. More of this interview is available at DelawarePublic.org. And we close out the show next with Art's Playlist and a preview of the latest exhibition debuting at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. There's a new exhibition coming to the Brandywine River Museum of Art this summer. Ralston Crawford, Air Plus Space Plus War, features the work of the modernist best known for his abstract representations of urban life and industry. And Brandywine River Museum of Art curator Amanda Burden joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist to preview this exhibition.
An exhibition that has been organized by our friends at the Vilcek Foundation, but they knew that I had an interest in Ralston Crawford, who is a preeminent American modernist. I have borrowed works by him before to show at the Brandywine, partly because he's such an important modernist, but he has a local connection as well. In the 1930s, he lived in and around the Brandywine area, Chadsford and Exton and Wilmington. And so it was an interesting story to see a modernist developing right in our own area in the 1930s. And so when this exhibition came to my attention, I knew we had to have it because it explores his transformation from an artist who was still working in a representational manner. He was painting the barns of Chester County and the Lucan Steel Mill out in Coatesville. And he transforms himself throughout World War II, in which he is a member of the Army Air Force, into a non-objective, an abstract painter. I shouldn't say non-objective, because we can actually see how he transforms in this exhibition from being representational to being abstract, to taking what he's seeing and playing with the forms and the colors and the shapes and making it less visually representational, but more packed with emotion, I think.
So how many works by Ralston Crawford in this new exhibit, which, by the way, goes on view June 20th and will stay on view through September 19th? How many works?
You know, the number seems to rise every day. We're at about 80 right now. And one of the reasons it's so many is the way the show is organized is that we take some of his major oil paintings throughout the war period, and we pair them with his preparatory work for them, his drawings, his studies, even photographs that he took as study material. So each work, even though it's a little abstract, a little difficult to see maybe exactly what is being represented, there actually is a clear path through these studies and sketches in his development, and you can see how the forms change and his ideas move along, and he decides to go with one shape versus another. So I think it's a really educational show that helps us see how an artist who works abstractly comes to those ideas.
Yeah, you're sort of going to narrate his involvement with World War II, and like you said, very educational. Do you expect lots of buses to come through with high school students or even younger students, since this will be sort of an educational exhibit?
You know, that would be the dream, but I think right now, because of COVID restrictions, schools are less able to do that. And of course, it will be up during the summer. So we will have a lot of educational programming around it. But I think who would be very interested are, you know, it's a large body of interested people in World War II, in the history of World War II, the many aspects of it, the personal stories, the military strategies, the different theaters, because Ralston Crawford is involved in all of that. He's a great war biography on top of being an artist.
Talk about some of the educational programming surrounding this exhibit.
Well, I think my favorite that I'm looking forward to is a conversation that we'll be having early on in the show, and it will be virtual, so people can join us from everywhere, which is a conversation with the artist's son, John Crawford. So he's been our link to understanding and finding this trove of material that he's preserved from his father's work. And we're matching them up with these paintings that are now in collections at the Whitney Museum or at Harvard Art Museums and the Hirshhorn. So that insight into the artist's life and work from his son, who is also an artist, you know, it's one artist to the next, one generation to the next. It's a very Brandywine approach, in a way, of multiple generations of artists in one family.
All right. I want to remind everyone, we're talking to the curator of the Brandywine River Museum of Art, Amanda Burden. Amanda is no stranger to the show. We're talking about a new exhibit coming in June. It's by Ralston Crawford. It's called Air Plus Space Plus War. What's the takeaway, Amanda? What do you want viewers who go through this exhibit, what do you want them to get out of this?
You know, I think my goals, or the Brandywine goals for this exhibit, are twofold. First, it is a rich story of an artist's participation in the war effort. And Ralston Crawford being part of the military machinery helped to, in his own artistic way, as part of the intelligence services of the war. And so that's a fascinating story to understand how an artist could contribute to the planning of D-Day and to the first atomic bomb test in the Bikini Atoll. You know, he looked at his work in the military as a stepping stone, as a way to learn more about his own art-making process. So on one hand, we hear one artist's story, And a few years ago, when we had the celebrations of the centennial of World War I, we did hear a lot of stories of how artists participated, making recruitment posters, being on site at the war and making sketches and studies. And this is the continuation, how an artist in now later in the 20th century could also make a contribution. And that in and of itself is a great story that combines art with world history. But the other aspect that I really am looking forward to presenting is bringing a kind of an understanding or an educational stepping stone, if you will, to dealing with abstracted art, more art that's less recognizable visually, because Crawford in these works takes us through step by step in these studies and sketches, and we see how something can go from a clear-cut photograph to being an abstract painting as we look at each of his stages. And I think that's really fascinating for the audience around our area who is used to the Brandywine showing very representational art. So that is a way that we can expand the horizons of our audience and help them work their way up to an appreciation of abstract art and proving there's nothing scary about abstract art at all.
Amanda, as we emerge, we continue to emerge, hopefully, from the COVID-19 pandemic. What are the hours like? I'm sure you have limited hours. Am I correct? Are you still practicing social distancing, mask wearing, that sort of thing?
Well, at the moment, the Brandywine is closed because we are undergoing construction. So with the opening of this exhibition, we will be setting the tone for the rest of the year. And of course, we will be following all of the CDC guidelines. We've been doing timed ticketing to ensure that there's no overcrowding in the gallery. As I'm planning this exhibition, it's going to be passed and laid out in a way that prevents crowding. We're having lots of space between the objects, large signage and labels, so nobody has to crowd in together. And what's great about this is when we launch this exhibition, we're also relaunching the museum after our construction. So we'll have a totally refreshed museum. The entire museum will be rehung with new signage. We'll have a new gallery on display. We'll have new functions for our audience members, a refreshed shop and restrooms. And so we're really taking the moment right now so that we can bring a whole new experience in June.
Again, we're talking to Amanda Burden. Amanda is the curator at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. And we're talking about a new exhibit coming in June, Ralston Crawford's Air Plus Space Plus War. Have you ever curated an exhibition of this type before, Amanda?
You know, I've done lots of monographic shows where you look at one artist. This may be the only time that I've looked at such a small window of an individual artist's work. This is about 10 years worth of work in an artist's career that has a much broader impact. In later in life, Crawford was really well known as a photographer and worked a lot in New Orleans. Earlier in his life, he was known as a precisionist painter. It was a very stylized, hard-edged, modernist style, which is what we've shown at the Brandywine before. But to dive in so deeply to a period of one artist's life and evaluate and look at all the factors that were coming together in his life, you know, he was in the military, but he was still taking commissions for private work. One of the commissions was for an airplane manufacturing company. He was working for Fortune magazine, doing a kind of illustration that I think N.C. Wyeth and his ilk had never even dreamed of in infographics for that magazine. He was also himself flying airplanes. Now, he wasn't a pilot, but he fell in love with flying, and having that aerial perspective mixes in here, and you'll see that in the works. So it was really great to dive in to just this moment in an artist's career, which was so noteworthy for changing his style and making him into a very abstract artist.
Final words, anything you want the public to know about it?
It might appeal even to a broader audience than an art-loving audience. You know, the name Ralston Crawford, to those of us who are Americanists or follow modern painting, might be familiar. I think it's such a wonderful story of someone who was trained and worked here in our local area in our Brandywine style, who exhibited side by side with the Wyeths and in Wilmington at the Pyle galleries, and how he evolved as an artist with this major move during the war. Now, of course, war changes lives no matter which war it is. And to witness that as an artist is just phenomenal, because he left us a visual record of how his life was changing. So I think it's a wonderful story of an artist, but it's also a fascinating military history as well. You know, even if the appeal of these paintings doesn't strike your fancy, the biography and the military history are really there to back it up and make it all the more enticing.
Thanks to Brandywine River Museum of Art curator Amanda Burton and our Kelly Steele for joining us on Arts Playlist. Ralston Crawford, Air Plus Space Plus War, opens June 20th at the Brandywine River Museum of Art in Chads Ford, PA. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.